Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Are you tired of using Google Drive or Dropbox to send files to clients? Well, never get burned again with FilePass. I love and use FilePass exclusively for sending files to my clients. It's a cloud file sharing website specifically made by engineers for engineers. It's absolutely amazing. Go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/FilePass to check out the full feature list and subscribe today. Never lose another dime to burned projects. Happy mixing, my friends, and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host DK, and with me as always is Never Wrong Lou. Ooh, that was not an L nickname.
That was not an L nickname, but we can say for the L name, you took an L.
Dude, I took an L for the L name there. Never Wrong Lou, because this episode is about things that we've been wrong about. And you know what? This episode is really hard for us because truly, factually, objectively, Lou and I have never been wrong ever in the history of our entire podcast. Ever have we ever flip-flopped on any sort of stance. We've never been wrong ever. Every day, even our wives admit that we are right all along, actually.
That's why we don't fight.
I'm being very sarcastic for those that don't get it. Yeah, these are like four or five different things, maybe more, that we've been wrong about that we want to clarify and why we've been wrong. And hopefully these are things that you learn about. Cool? Fair
Let's
enough? Easy enough? Let this be an effective short episode. Let this be efficient. Number one, Lou, do you want to talk about gear and nice gear is important?
Oh, yes, yes. All right. So I've been wrong in saying that having really nice gear doesn't make the difference in a record, which is, I'm going to say it like this. Before, I would say it's an absolute, like, no, it doesn't make the difference. The record is the record and this and that. That is true. But as a professional, gear does make the difference that people want in a record in the context of recording. You know, a good mic, a good preamp, a good compressor, you know, if you want an EQ on the way in, a good EQ does make the world of a difference in the quality of production that's going into the mixing phase. I would say it like that. I still believe that gear overall is not that relevant. It really isn't. But when it comes to the recording process, I've flip-flopped into saying it matters in the recording process. After that, it matters significantly less. At least
I agree
to the success of a record.
Great. I think you also mentioned, let's go into as well as, this is something that I can't really speak on, but you said that I've also flip-flopped on the importance and love of gear or something like that.
Yes, gear in place of a professional mixer or mastering engineer's workflow. Whereas
did I flip-flop on?
Yes. And I'll explain it and you'll see why. You'll see why. It still works. It still works. It's not saying that gear is bad or gear is good or whatever. But when we first met, I think you had the WA76 and the WA bus comp. I think that was it. I think that was the core of the gear that you had outside of your ATCs and the Apollo. Yeah. But me and you had long talks about, like, you know, you still mainly work in the box because having gear and having to do recalls, having to do this because of the revision stages and all that actually significantly slows down the workflow. And so it just really doesn't serve a purpose in a professional engineer's tool set, because it's actually working against them. But then I remember there was a stage where you bought some gear, tried it out, and you're like, you know, I kind of want to expand more into analog gear again. And then it went back to...
I do always have, like, sometimes I hate it, sometimes I love it.
Exactly. But then we tried I think it's called the EL Fatso from Empirical Labs. And around that time, I had also bought the Dangerous 2 Bus Plus. Was that what it's called?
I returned my Fatso.
The A to D converter, the AD Plus. Yeah. That's what it was called. But me and you were always trying to see if we can recreate what we were hearing with it. We were able to create the AD Plus like nothing. I never tried the Fatso myself, but I remember you were telling me, you're like, you know what? I'm going to return it. I'm like, really? You just got it? Like, what happened? And you're like, it's just that I can recreate it in the box significantly easier and I don't have to deal with, you know, recalls. I'm not going to use it in the recording process. It doesn't feel like it's going to really help me in any way right now. Like, I'm just going to stick to in the box.
Yeah, and it was mostly because it took too long to dial in.
Yeah.
It took way too long. Like, the left and right were not exactly
on.
Stereo. It wasn't perfect.
And see, that's where the fallacy of analog came into play in our conversations, where it's like, it's never really perfect. If you want consistency, you want recallability, you'd want to not have to deal with potential issues when you got deadlines, just stay in the box. But recently, you're back on gear again, where you have the Weiss compressor. You have the Cayenne. West Audio, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
You have the West Audio, you have the Cayenne, and you have the, what is it, the EL something?
ENC, the Electric and Company EC5B.
Yeah. So I think this is the stage of your career where I've seen you with the most gear for the most consistent amount of time without not using it and then using it. I know that you've like still done mixes completely in the box and some not completely in the boxes. But I think that your workflow has changed to more of a hybrid than ever before.
It's true. And more so that I enjoy it. I'm actually enjoying it.
Yeah. Versus before, it was more about the conversation of efficiency than the enjoyment of it. While we both still agreed, yeah, you could have gears that you enjoy, but it's not efficient. But I think you found a level of efficiency in your workflow to kind of say that, you know what, that's not really the case anymore.
Yeah. And it's definitely unrelated to the amount of money per dollars that I make per projects now, where I can justify that.
Yeah.
The time spent on it.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with that for sure. But yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, I went from... You don't need it. It's not fun. And I do think that that's like practical advice for mixing and mastering specifically. You don't need it. You don't need it. It costs you money. It makes you slower.
And if you're doing it for validation, guess what? Nobody cares.
Yeah, nobody cares. and you won't all of a sudden become a better mixer.
Yeah. And you won't all of a sudden get hired that much more. You might get a few more clients, but it's usually insecure clients.
The two things that I can't, I will be open now about is one, it's fun. And it changes, and I'm, by the way, I'm very picky with my outboard gear. So like part of me is like, I really enjoy the sound that it gives. And like, I don't know how it's going to sound when it goes through the stuff that I have. It's like, it's interesting. It's fun. It like kind of morphs and changes for each song. And then, the second thing is, I think it's practical to leave people thinking that I have some sort of secret sauce.
Yeah.
From a branding perspective, this is, I don't want to say that it was influenced from 48 Laws of Power because that's not necessarily true. But there is a law about letting people think that you have some sort of secret or that like you're just ultra talented.
So I'm gonna give you a fun, similar reference to that.
Uh-huh.
One time I was on Reddit and I love going on Reddit's like, popular or whatever tabs, like whatever, something's just going on and there seems to be a lot of traction behind it, right?
Uh-huh.
And sadly, a lot of times it's political, religious, it's things in the world, but sometimes you find that one that's just really funny. It's just like, am I really reading this, right? And somebody was like, 9/11 was fake. And it's like, what? And then it goes in the description. It's like, not really, but hear me out. Wouldn't it be better for the government to have its people think that it was capable of faking something and making something like this happen and still getting away with it? Like, wouldn't that be better for them because now we believe they have this amount of power over us than they really do? Like, that's the secret sauce. It's like, maybe it's better for people to just believe that something is within your realm and capabilities than it really is.
Yeah,
maybe it is nice for them to think that DK's got this secret sauce revolving around some mystery piece of gear that nobody else has.
Yeah, dude. It's true, dude. It's the more gear that I have, the larger my dick gets. No, I'm just kidding.
Actually, that's not a mystery. That's fact. I unfortunately have the opposite effect. It's the reason I'm selling so much gear.
I'm trying to regain what I lost. Dude, it's just power, dude. It's just power. I'm just continuing to collect gear to show power and to have power.
Gear, what was it?
One piece of gear equals, depending on the piece of gear, one gear equals one power unit.
What was the quote from the podcast from before? It's, what is mastering? it's the dick you sling over your shoulder as you kiss your model wife in the morning.
Yeah, like that. You still repost that one. That's like,
dude, that one's hilarious. Huh? That was because we didn't plan that at all. Take. That was not scripted. Yeah. That was just hilarious.
Oh, dude, it's as if anything we do is scripted. That's crazy.
I know, seriously.
All right, I have another one for you. Number one for me is ever joking about or hating on revisions. That's the big thing that I was wrong on. And it's not so much that I had an opinion on that I was wrong, but it was wrong that I acted that way, that I even insinuated that, jokingly even so. Like, yeah, sure, revisions can be tedious and annoying sometimes, but I was wrong for ever allowing my clients to think that I didn't like it.
Yeah.
I have done so much better and have had so much success, so much more success convincing clients to trust me when I am open about and letting them know that I love revisions. I'm very open to revisions. I love to collaborate. As soon as I articulate that to the client, they are so much happier. They feel, and some of them have articulated like, oh, that's great. You're the first engineer that's actually said that. Most engineers hate revisions, so I feel bad about asking for revisions. But if I'm like very open and I lower that boundary and I'm say like learn to appreciate the revision and the collaborative process by letting go of my personal ego, I find that the client is happier and we make better art together. And I was wrong about ever joking, making fun of, or minimizing clients' desires for revisions.
Yeah.
I was wrong. And I think that I have made more money now being open to it than I have ever, like, yeah, there's nothing beneficial about being open about hating to do revisions. And this is a recent flip-flop of mine. Like, I'm very open about that I love revisions. And that seems to be super helpful. I can't believe that. It's so much so that I can't believe that I ever hated on that openly. I feel very embarrassed about that.
Now, I will say that I think this is something that comes with the frustration of the early stages.
Yeah, I'm not saying that I'm not frustrated, but I'm saying that into the open public.
Yeah.
That, well, I've allowed that thought to persist.
But that's what I mean. I think that a lot of people want to hear confidence, right? And because of that, we believe that we need to be confident in our statements and how we believe and what we think. Not realizing that not everything needs to be vocalized publicly. You can feel how you want to feel, but you need to remember that you were fostering a community that is here to support each other at the end of the day. Like, no business works without like its core clientele, right? And if the core clientele knows that you hate a certain part of your job, they're not going to ask you to do a certain part of your job. And if that certain part of the job is the ending stage of it, then they feel like, okay, if we don't get it right on the first go, then, you know, I just feel really bad every time I hire him because I know he doesn't want to finish the project when it's just not to our liking.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And that's a big misconception early on because, once again, we're trying to promote ourselves as confident people and that our product is superior and you should work with us. But
I think there's an air of, like you said, there's an air of confidence that comes from being super open to revisions.
Yeah.
That's also a very confident power move.
Yeah. That's why a lot of times nowadays, when I talk to people, especially if I'm doing live sound, right? I've met a lot of people who have had nightmare situations with engineers at other locations or other events and this and that. And a lot of times I'm doing, you know, like nowadays the shows that I'm doing average of a minimum of like 2,000 people per event. So we're talking like decent ticket sales and all that, and a lot of pressure for the act to do well on stage and stuff. But a lot of engineers have this weird notion of like, hey, if they need something in their monitor and you're not giving it, and the only reason that you're not giving it is because like, oh, the monitors sound fine. It's plenty loud, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like, hey man, like this would actually help them. And because of that, they go to other events, assuming that other engineers kind of react the same. So whenever I give them this kind of experience where it's like, yeah, what do you need? Okay, cool. No worries. I got you. Oh, you came with your own stage plot and everything. No worries. Let's get that set up, and just like working with them and still checking in. Hey, is everything good? I just want to make sure that you're enjoying yourself. Hey, before we go on, I made sure to replace the batteries on the wireless, this and that, you know, just doing that. Like it may be tedious little things, but they make the difference in the experience of the performers and things of that nature. When you're in studio, there's not necessarily the notion of like, oh, there's 2,000 people about to watch them right now. But you know, if they're paying per hour, let's say that it's not a day rate studio, but like a per hour studio, for every hour that they're not confident in something, that might be, you know, them overthinking it, trying to get new takes, this and that. It's on us to make them feel comfortable. It's on us to make them feel confident in what's going on. And so whenever we communicate things like, oh, we just don't like doing revisions, it makes them less confident. And if they're feeling inconfident about something that they're working on, they're not going to want to hit you up about it and then put themselves in a further more awkward position. That's just, it's awkward. It's already awkward to not feel confident. And it's awkward to tell somebody that you don't feel confident about something you're working on together when you know that they don't like revisions. You're just making it that much harder for them to want to communicate with you openly and honestly.
That's true. And if people already have a hard time openly and honestly communicating, why would you make it harder?
Yeah.
Okay. The second thing that I want to talk about, you mentioned about changing your, you were wrong about something about the power of internships.
Yes. Yes. This is where ego comes into play. Yes. Yes. Okay. Sorry. I'm going to stop saying yes.
Okay.
But basically, this is something that I had to grow my mindset out of, and I suggest for everyone moving forward. Early on in my career, you know, I was on that peak of that confidence curve where you believe you know everything and you don't know shit. And so because of that, whenever I applied for an internship, I applied with the intention of showcasing why I'm the superior intern in the room. And that they should hire me as soon as possible before I move on. That was my mindset. And I'm not going to lie. It did actually work plenty of times because confidence sells. Confidence in what you're doing and what, as long as you actually know what you're talking about, does sell. But overconfidence and underestimating the value of an internship is actually pretty detrimental. A good example of this would be if you ever interned for us at the studio, you would know that I would offer free office hours. And those office hours were twice a week. And I think I offered like, what was it? Two to four hours per day, 2 days a week, I think it was. I forget what the exact amount of time was, but I would tell everybody like, hey, if you want a lesson, if you want to understand something, if you want critiques, blah, 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 just book one of my office hours, and I will give you lessons for free. Those lessons were just as long, if not longer, than I ever promised. Like sometimes people would come in for a 1 hour lesson. I'd give them a 3 hour lesson at no cost, no complaining of like how long this is taking, just because I genuinely wanted to help our team. I never looked at internships as that when I took on internships. I took on internships as a, you know what? They're only going to hire one of us, so I better showcase myself to be the best one, right? But now I tell people like, yo, take an internship just to take the internship. Just go. Who cares? Like, I've even thought about applying to Village recently just so I can go see what the interns are doing at Village and see the workflow of Village and just learn about Village. I don't give a shit about who I end up working with at that point. I really don't care. I'm not doing it for a very specific goal outside of, you know what? If I were to go apply as an intern now at Village, I would just want to understand the actual core business fundamentals of how that place operates. I would actually want to hit up the management and be like, what do you do on a daily basis as a manager of Village? You're not one of the engineers. I mean, you might be an engineer. You might mix and master for a living too. Shit, I don't know. But I'm fascinated by the fact that Village has maintained a sense of, you know, exclusivity all these years. It's become synonymous with success.
Dude, like, that's crazy. Like, we've done so many episodes about how to be a good intern, and you're finally recognizing that that's what we've been talking about.
Yeah, right? But that's my point. Like, I don't think it's a flip-flop in saying that I've never been telling people be a good intern. I think I was a bad intern. I think
you weren't following
as
your own
intern,
advice.
Yeah, I wish
you
I
never
did.
You were able to give advice based on your perspective as the manager, but you yourself never saw the correct perspective as the person getting the intern.
Exactly. Yeah, I feel like I'm not saying that, oh, I regret not doing something more or whatever. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is, like, you know what? The internship is significantly more helpful and powerful to cultivating a successful career than I believed it to be in the past, back when I was interning.
Yeah.
I saw it more as like a chore list, check off box to getting to your next destination in your career. Like, you intern, somebody discovers you, you move on from the internship, you're no longer an intern ever again, and that part of your life is done. But rather, we know people who are our age who interned and became assistants and then actually got to learn directly from some really successful names in our industry. And because of that, they say that they've actually learned more about their mixing style and have elevated their success rate by understanding how they manage their business versus just being like, I'm already good, you should pay me.
Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So you're now, you flip-flopped and understand the value of being open to new experiences and learning from them.
Yeah.
For nothing other than the purpose of having a new experience.
Yeah. At this point, I'm very much I went up to a card shop a year ago and they actually took me up on this offer and I did learn a lot, which is, hey, I just want to understand how this side of the industry works. How do you do your things?
So before you were a dumbass.
Yes,
and now
absolutely.
You're like
absolutely.
Slightly more intellectual.
I would say I'm still not intellectual, but rather a little more along the lines of average. No.
Number two. Well, my second thing is an easy one here. All of mine is very, like, very technical. I used to think I don't need subs. I don't need subs. I like a sub, and I've experienced having subs before. Mm-hmm. And then I went like a couple years without any subs. And I had ever since I got these two-way Strauss monitors here. And yeah, I was like, I don't need a sub. These go really low, actually. Lower than the ATCs. Mm-hmm. I can hear that information. And then I decided to go all in on having... Oh, excuse me. Not just one sub, but I have two subs. And like, really well-tuned room for the subs. I even got the crossover, an external outboard crossover to like deal with. And I've like taken the time to dial them in. Not to feel, but like to graph. I can mix way better now. Like that. Yeah, no, it's very practical and useful to have subwoofers. And if anything, I now have a problem that I'm afraid to mix without subwoofers because I I just feel like the information that I was used to mixing without, now I'm realizing like how important that information actually is.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So it's like, especially because like, you know, AirPods blow low end out. And yeah, if you don't have subs, it's like difficult to hear. And here's the thing too. It's like, this is also in correlation with like, I used to think and give too much respect to the low end in headphones. These headphones are rated to go down 20 hertz. So of course there's like low headphone range extension. No, there isn't. There isn't. It's different. It feels different. It is different. Yeah, there's something about actual subwoofers. And I don't have like a huge room. I have a big enough room, but I don't have a huge room. And the fact that I have subwoofers, I think like, yeah, no, that was an experience that I don't know if I ever went as far as to like shit talk. And it's like, you don't need it. People that are have subs are like, you know, facetious or whatever. You know, they're involved with themselves. I don't know. I don't know if I ever went that far, but I can now say like, no, yeah, it's definitely made a huge dramatic difference in how I listen to my mixes and the decisions that I make. And I underestimated how much of a difference it would be. Yeah, so I was wrong about that. Yeah, you kind of need subs. It'd be nice if you had subs and not just like your KRK sub, but like a real sub. Although like a nice KRK sub that only goes to 30 hertz is still like worth it. It's still good, but there's something about having two subs that go down to 16 hertz in a room that I've tuned to make it feel good and sound good is game changer.
Oh yeah.
Genuinely. That's my second thing I was wrong about. All right, Lou, you talked about something about taking on every gig.
Ooh, yes. This one's sweet and simple. When I first started, I took on any and every gig that I could possibly think was even remotely related to the general idea of working in audio. I think that was cool. I think that did open a lot of doors, but I think I wasn't selective enough while also being like at all selective. And I think that was the issue.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
What do you mean?
So,
yeah, explain.
So I was selective a little bit, but in all honesty, if I were to compare it to like the rest of my career, I don't think I was selective enough. Reason being is that I do believe that taking on every gig, every opportunity you can is important, but some gigs are more of something that has nothing to do with the path you're trying to go on than it. So at that point, is it really beneficial for you to take on it? You can always meet somebody, you can always run into somebody, and you never know, right? But an example of this for me would be like doing podcast recordings. I think that's kind of cool, working with like other podcasters, and that could lead to a different side industry. But it doesn't actually, outside of doing a podcast ourselves, it doesn't actually relate to what I want to do as an engineer. You know, talking on a podcast, totally cool with that. But I don't want to be in a podcast studio recording podcasts 8 hours a day. I think I'd blow my brains out. With that said, I don't think it would have been a good idea to take on that gig unless I was really trying to build in that and have all my time dedicated to that.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So I want to differentiate because I still think that trying everything is good advice for the beginner that doesn't
know what to do. Yeah. Yeah.
But if
like
you're
try
starting
it out just for the experience.
Yeah, but you're talking about like once you kind of have an idea of what you want to do, it's still saying yes to everything. Like the number one advice that is I assume that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But the number one advice from like Leslie, and like this is not just from Leslie, but like pretty typical advice. Like if you want to be a mixer in the music industry, you have to stop recording and stop producing. You have to stop doing everything else. And I think it's also like partially like the psychology of like the client of like creating a brand that specializes in one thing and creating respect for that one piece of art or technique that you're slowly start to become known for. Or and as well as like the opportunities that you create for yourself, just like what you're saying. Like,
yeah, I think it's a good idea to niche. It is bad to niche too soon. Some people try to force their niche and it doesn't work out. Right.
So what were you wrong about, Lou?
What I was wrong about is not starting to say no soon enough to specific things. I don't think you necessarily have to niche right away or find your niche as you go too soon. But I think it's okay to start cutting out things you have no interest or intention with. Like, if you don't want to do live sound, then just say no to live sound gigs. You can say yes to anything and you can meet anybody anywhere at an early stage. And if you try it out and it's not something for you, just start saying no to those gigs. It's okay. You don't have to take on every gig until you're ultimately successful. It's okay to just honestly keep pushing, trucking along as a recording engineer until you get to what you want to do. But if they're asking you to record like a church sermon and you have no interest in doing that and you don't really want to be doing that, even if it's once a week, then it's okay to just say no to it. Like, it's okay to start niching away from certain things, if that makes sense. Like, just cut the fat. Cut the fat. Like, focus on what you actually want to start doing on and taking on every gig related to that. But don't just say yes with the widest net you can possibly cast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Like, if you want to be a mixer, then what good is it to be known as the guy that's recording football games for NBC? That's a cool side quest.
It's called the golden handcuffs. Happens all the time to entrepreneurs. They're trying to start their own business, but they're making too much money from their day job, so they're unable to dedicate more time to their business.
Yep.
Golden handcuffs. Mm-hmm. This is part of the reason why I've always, like, blatantly and very boldly say no to like other gigs in the past. Like, I've had a few opportunities to do like dialogue editing or like sound design for film and TV, which makes more money mm-hmm. and has more gigs, more opportunities. I'm very aware that it is a very dangerous and slippery slope, and I do not want to be tied with the golden handcuffs. I've mm-hmm. said no just to make sure that I never receive the opportunity to jump out of what I really want. And I think that's also like the idea of like, I've always had a very strong sense of what I want. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's like a talent that I have as much as like the effort that I've put in to figure out what it is exactly that I want. That's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah.
Being able to articulate what you want, figuring out what you want and pursuing that is a matter of work. It's not something that people are born with and they know what they want to do. No, like, I think people, even the people that have a very strong idea, have put in the conscious effort to figure out and to think about, to consider what is it that they want to do.
Yeah.
And then commit. And then the ability to commit after that. Okay. So cool. You were wrong about the taking every gear thing. Mine's another technical one here. Last one here is, this is an old one. But we were very big skeptics on Sound ID.
Yeah. We're like,
we were huge skeptics about it. We used to be.
Yeah.
And then I got it. And then you got it.
Yeah.
And I've never not used it ever since.
I have stopped using it, but not because it's not a good resource. I think it's just a matter of like how it works in my setup.
Okay. Yeah. But I was wrong about ever hating on it and being skeptical about it. Like, it's great. I mean, it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. There's still some things about it that's not perfect. But what a great tool. What a great tool. I'm still very skeptical about other emulation and sound correction profile software from a headphone company that makes a subscription plugin service that will not be named.
Mm-hmm.
Owned by a pretty creepy looking Chad.
I'm not going to lie. I've never heard somebody vocalize it, but yes. Yes.
Yeah. We won't speak on that.
Nope.
Yeah, I don't hate that service. I'm still very skeptical about it. And that's coming from a guy that used it. That being said, Sonar Works immediately. It was like, oh, night and day. Like, oh, wow, this is actually really practical and helpful.
Yeah.
From a philosophical level, it's weird to use Sound ID. But from like a practical level, very practical. Very practical.
Yeah.
Very practical.
I think a good example of like one of the benefits that Sound ID is able to do that I was, we didn't actually have this interaction on the basis of Sound ID being relevant in our studio life just yet. But I remember early on in the mix, we had the question in our head, is there something wrong with the ATCs? I don't know if you remember where like the one on the right sounded quieter, but yet they were both turned up to max. They were both turned to the exact same settings and everything. And something was just off. And I'm like, hear me out. And I nudged it like maybe a quarter of an inch forward or something. And you're like, whoa, what'd you do? What'd you change? And I'm like, I just moved the speaker like a quarter of an inch. You're like, it sounds perfect. It sounds centered now. And it's like,
it must have been a phase thing, huh?
Yeah, it literally was. Because the way your ears work is if you hear something sooner, it could be the same exact audio from two different locations, but whichever side arrives closest to you faster, you kind of perceive that one as louder, you know, because it's coming from both places, but it's not enough of a delay for you to perceive like location necessarily right away. Like if it's not like that much of a difference. Like if it's 1 foot closer, you obviously feel like that thing's closer. But if it's like a quarter of an inch and it's like 3-4 feet away from you, like you don't necessarily immediately perceive distance. You just feel like something got to your ear a bit louder, and that phase might be an issue there. But Sound ID will correct that like quarter of an inch. You see the measurement in its software where it's like, oh yeah, it was like 0.2 milliseconds off. Yeah. It'll make that correction, and suddenly you see your stereo image just line up right in front of you.
Yeah, dude, it's been super great. Sound ID, I was wrong about ever questioning its effectiveness. Love it.
Sound ID
doesn't solve all problems. Doesn't solve all problems, but
yeah, the main thing that a lot of people hate on it for is literally the idea of acoustic treatment being necessary or not. Acoustic treatment is still ultimately necessary and is arguably like the first thing people would say should be on your checklist of things you need for a studio. Because you know, me and DK, we have really nice Strauss speakers. We really like our speakers, but Sound ID still helps them out.
Yeah.
You know?
It's true.
Yeah.
Love him. Love him. Love the speakers. Love Sound ID. Yeah. So sub Sound ID revisions. And you said importance of gear, usefulness of gear, taking on every gig and recording gear. Cool. Yeah. That's it. Yeah, dude, I was wrong about you, dude. You're actually kind of nice.
Oh.
I'm just kidding. That was
I wish I was kind of more of an asshole then.
Dude,
I don't like being
care. I don't care what Anna says about you, dude. You're a good guy.
Good. I'm glad she talks shit about me. Obviously, we're kidding, guys.
Yeah, dude, I was wrong about having a family. No, imagine, dude.
Oh, my God. That'd be quite the episode.
I'm kidding, dude. Of course. I'm the biggest family. Other people with families are always impressed with how much of a family guy I am. Like, damn, dude, I have kids too, and I love them to death. But, dude, I don't spend half the amount of time as you do with them.
Right.
Yeah, dude. I'm a through and through family guy.
I think the last thing I could say I was wrong about, which you brought up earlier, which was social media.
Oh, you yeah. know? Say this. Speak on it.
Yes. Speak on it. Got a hawk to and speak on it. No. God, I hate that like as much as I enjoy the joke that it's that normalized as a joke.
We all hate that. We all hate it.
It's like, why did that joke have to be so good? I hate it.
Nobody said it was good, dude.
I did. When I first heard that thing, I started cackling. And then I saw how big it got and I'm like, oh no, I'm part of it.
Oh man, I must yeah. have, dude, I but, was like, oh wow.
With that said, social media, it is wildly important for different factors and it's going to perform different depending on how you approach it. You know, some people approach it with a very specific intent. Like one can say that the Mixing Music Podcast is so geared towards engineers and people looking to build a career as a working professional in the industry that it doesn't work well as a sourcing platform for potential mixing or mastering clients, right? Because of the way we approach it. I don't know. I don't have the data on that, but I would say that most mixing engineers are not trying to hire mixing engineers. That's the logic behind my thought on that one.
Yeah.
I'm on social media just making content just to kind of just say, hey, I'm Lou. I'm still mixing and mastering. If you want to work together, that's cool. But outside of that, listen, I've recently started creating YouTube videos and this is what they're about. You know, check them out if you'd like. I started my email campaigns and so much other. I recently created an email campaign with automations and everything that lasts for 3 months. So every time somebody downloads a vocal template, I have an automatic marketing plan that gets set into place through automation. All of this, I wouldn't say directly has resulted in new bookings or anything, but rather conversations being sparked, which keeps me relevant in the mind of people that I maybe don't talk to every day. And they feel more confident in saying, hey, I want to reach out about a question about what you were talking about, this and that. Hey, I have a new room and I was looking at monitors. I remember you talked about this on a video. I wanted to pick your brain a little bit. And it's kind of a nice conversation starter, the way it's kind of worked out for me. And that's actually led to a few gigs. In fact, one of them led to a room calibration setup. Another one led to acoustic panel sales. Another one led to an album worth of mixing. But it all just started conversations. I wouldn't say that this is necessarily like the best thing that I've ever done and it's resulted in the most work that I've done. But I can't deny the fact that it's actually supplemented my income in a way that wouldn't have existed if had I just completely denied social media the way I used to. And the logic that I had before was, I don't care what you say on social media. You are who you are based on your actions and what you do in real life. Social media only gives you a glimpse of our life. And I still believe that.
Yeah, you're just reminding people that you exist. Hey, remember, yeah. I'm here. And first to mind is always first to hire.
Exactly. Now, with that said, I'm still a core believer that as much as this opens doors, I think you yourself, not your content, but you yourself have to follow through on whatever comes of it. You know, so your content is actually very good at, like DK just said, first to mind, first to hire. But yeah, before that wasn't really an issue for me because I was just working and I was already in front of people. So I was always, you know, top of mind because they have to communicate with me related to projects we're actively working on. And when new projects come up, they know they have somebody who they can trust. And so because of that, I don't necessarily associate social media as like the reason I get hired for bigger gigs. It's rather the trust I built with people through my actual work ethic. But social media makes sure that people know that you're still working, even if they don't see you in a while, you haven't talked in a while, but they still see you actively doing your thing. You're posting about certain successes, letting people know that, hey, you know, I'm not saying that I'm not relevant or I am relevant, but, you know, here's an update if you were looking for one.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, that's a great one to end it off of. Keep using social media. Don't downplay it. It's great for building clientele.
Literally, my YouTube channel intro video says that I'm doing it just so I can get over myself and my fear of being on camera.
Yeah. There you go.
Get over yourself.
All right. That's it for this episode. Get over yourself.
Just remember, we were wrong before. We'll be wrong again.
Go read a book, people. That's my, that's probably one of my favorite Dave Chappelle lines. I think he was on SNL and like he said something ignorant, like the character's line said something ignorant. And he's like, read a book, people. I don't know. It was just so funny. I need to find it later. But anyway, that's it. Otherwise, if you want more technical skills on other things that we may be right or wrong about, go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive. That's what it was. mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive for exclusive content. For $4 a month or $40 a year, you can unlock not just 2 new episodes every single week, but unlock a library of all the past episodes. So you know those exclusive archives that you jump into every week? Well, that's only just the tip of the iceberg. We bring 2 new ones every single week. And on top of that, there's already a library of hundreds and hundreds that you've never even heard before. So go check it out, mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive. And on that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get three-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.